Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Caitlin Freeman, who's an Alexander Technique teacher in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She teaches a variety of students, but she specializes in working with people who have autism or are on the autism spectrum. She's been a featured presenter at the Autism Society of America and other autism support organizations. And she's also the author of a book called Autism and Alexander Technique, and I believe there's a subtitle, but if you do a search for that on Amazon, you'll be able to find it very easily. And we're going to talk today about some suggestions that Caitlin would have for teachers, for Alexander Technique teachers who are working, who have students who are on the autism spectrum. And also a little bit, I think at the end, some suggestions for students who are on the autism spectrum who are interested in exploring the Alexander Technique. So that said, welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our second conversation.
Yes.
And it's all happening very fast. I'm not gonna ask you to give an Alexander Technique description this time, but I think it would be good if you could give our listeners just a very short definition or description of autism, and particularly what the term autism spectrum means.
Sure thing. So autism is, it's a neurological condition first and foremost. It's not a psychological condition as it has been diagnosed in the past. And it basically follows, it has a genetic component to it. It is an interaction between genes and the environment. So you have to have the genes for it, and then you have an environmental trigger that sets it off. And it is an autoimmunity, which is really what we understand about it at this point. And it causes a restructuring of the person's brain, the individual's brain, at an early age. So really, you know, before the age of two. And that restructuring of the brain leads to processing speed delays. It leads to difficulties in social cognition, basically understanding social interactions because of those processing speed delays. It leads to difficulties with processing sensory information. So just the information coming in from the senses is just garbled in various ways. And it also leads to a really heightened stress response. So people with autism tend to, it's just their stress response is on a hair trigger. And I was saying in my previous interview, one kind of little analogy that I like to use to kind of explain the whole autism spectrum. Basically, you can have a little bit of autism. You can have a lot of autism is one way to think about it. But one way that I like to think about it is that, you know, you have a cup of coffee and you can pour cream into it and you can get kind of different gradations of coffee. And that's sort of the same thing with autism. You can have a spectrum of different expressions. And those expressions really can go everything from somebody who, you know, maybe is on the ADHD side of things all the way to the really profound autism side of things. It really depends on how the person's brain is wired, how their nervous system is wired from that developmental age.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get in a minute to some of the suggestions for Alexander teachers who mm-hmm. have a student who is on the spectrum. But I do think it would be nice if you could tell a little bit about your own personal history with autism and the Alexander Technique. I think that will help people get a better sense of how these two can connect.
Sure. Well, I have a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, which the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that they use to classify all of these different conditions, has changed recently so that Asperger's syndrome is no more. It has gone the way of manic depression and various other things
that
people can be diagnosed with. And so it's now just called autism spectrum disorder. So everything is just called autism spectrum disorder. That was my diagnosis. Now it's just autism spectrum disorder. When I was young, my mother has a story that she talked to my nursery school teacher and was concerned about some repetitive behaviors that I was having and some real difficulties with social interaction that I was having and some sensory issues that I was having. And my mother is an early childhood educator, and she recognized that there was something not quite there, not quite, you know, the way that it quote unquote should be. She asked my nursery school teacher, well, you know, is it possible that my daughter has autism? And my nursery school teacher said, oh, no, don't worry about it. If she were autistic, she would be sitting in a corner banging her head against a wall. That was what people used to think autism was. Now, there are people who have their sensory systems so overwhelmed, overloaded, who are so overcome by sensory stimulus, their processing speed delays are so great that that's really what they can do, that is their level of functioning. I was not at that level. I was at a different level of functioning, but was still quite autistic, as we found out, as I found out later on when I visited several different psychologists. I really had no sense of my body. I had no sense of where I was in space. I had no real sense of how I interacted with other people. I was kind of a little self-contained unit, quite lonely, but still a separate unit from other people. And proverbial klutz, tripping over things. There was one time where I skinned my knee quite badly, didn't even notice it, but at the same time, and got other injuries and just, you know, didn't even really feel them. But at the same time, light touch on my skin felt like an electrical shock. So this is this kind of contradictory thing about autism where, you know, the senses are just garbled, where something that quote unquote shouldn't feel painful does, but something that quote unquote should feel painful doesn't. So I was, my nervous system was in all sorts of different places, and I was not kind of coalescing together as a functioning whole. And when I got to be in my 20s, it got pretty bad. And I'd graduated from college. I was sort of fishing around for what in the world was I going to do? And sort of also along the lines of, you know, what's wrong with me? Because obviously I wasn't functioning at the level that my peers were, and I didn't quite understand what was going on. And a friend of my family, a good longtime friend of my family, who is also an Alexander Technique teacher, Lisa First, suggested, well, why don't you try Alexander Technique? And so that little phone conversation led me to finding an Alexander teacher where I was in Cincinnati and starting taking lessons. And I wasn't in Cincinnati, near Cincinnati, but I was working with a teacher from Cincinnati, and it was like a whole new world of sensory experience started to materialize before me. And I was suddenly realized that I had legs and that my body isn't just kind of this amorphous blob, and I can look at somebody in the eye without feeling overwhelmed, and my skin doesn't feel like it's burning whenever somebody touches me. I can hug people now. I mean, it was a rather quick. I mean, I did 30 lessons with in the midst of that, I realized that I really wanted to train to teach Alexander Technique. But it was a fairly quick process, mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to the years and years that it, you know, it a lot of times takes for other therapies. It was pretty fast. And I started to kind of coalesce mm-hmm. in terms of my experience of the world. And I mean, I kind of liken it to The Wizard of Oz, where, you know, Dorothy lands in Oz and suddenly the world is in color. And it was kind of like that. It was a real change in perception. And
it sounds like, from the way you described mm-hmm. that it was a fairly, fairly painless process.
Oh, yeah.
Now, do you think for some people it might not be quite that smooth?
Oh, it's entirely possible. There mm-hmm. there's a great phrase that says, when you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, which basically means that no two people on the spectrum are going to have the same experience. The neurology is always a little different. Right. My experience working with students on the spectrum is that it is a very profound technique, and you know, none of my students have gone on to desire to become teachers. It hasn't struck them that profoundly.
Right.
But it has been a real benefit mm-hmm. to them in terms of managing their sensory experience. There was one gentleman that I worked with who wasn't able to go to his place of worship because he just felt overwhelmed whenever he would go. And so he would go with his wife and he would sit in the hallway because that was where he was comfortable. And through a course of Alexander lessons, and I don't think that we had that many lessons. It was, you know, I think less than 10. Mm-hmm. He was able to regulate his nervous system to a point where he was able to go in and enjoy the services, that the noises weren't too loud, that the mm-hmm. the lighting there wasn't too bright, that just being in amongst that many people wasn't overwhelming for him. He was able to regulate his own nervous system. So that's really the benefit. That's the gift that Alexander Technique is able to give people right. With neurological differences, these type of sensory challenges.
Right. And as you mentioned in our earlier interview, one of the huge benefits of the technique is that mm-hmm. for people with autism, which is also a benefit for pretty much everyone, is creating a little space between stimulus and response.
Right.
And from our other conversation, that space, that issue, that stimulus response issue, is often heightened for people on the spectrum, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the analogy that I use, and I use, forgive me, I'll use it again here, is that imagine that you have a really bad hangover and that you feel terrible and everything is too bright and the sounds are too loud and everything, it just, you know, everything on your skin just feels uncomfortable. And then imagine that you go to an amusement park and you're riding on the amusement park rides and you're in the fun house and everything looks funny and you're just in this state of just complete overwhelm, and then take that times about 10 mm-hmm. and then imagine that is the experience that you have just walking out of your house right. and just hearing the noise of traffic or, you know, going to the bank or, you know, riding on the bus. I mean, just these very normal everyday things that we all do. That's the experience, is that it is this sensory overload, and that you know, taking that time, having the tools to be able to create the space between stimulus and response, to be able to quiet down the activity of the nervous system, is you know, it's manna from heaven. It's just right, it is incredibly powerful.
So obviously a teacher who has a new student who is diagnosed with being on the autism spectrum, it's obviously pretty useful for them to understand that overload issue.
Yes.
But how maybe it would be helpful for teachers to, if you could give some very specific ways in which they need to take that into account.
Yep, absolutely. So this is my reduced distraction talk.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of times people who don't have these types of sensory challenges are really not aware of how the sensory environment feels for somebody who does have these sensory challenges. So really what you want to do is you want to reduce distraction in all of the sensory systems. So you want to reduce visual distraction. So if you have, for instance, fluorescent lighting in your place of work, you probably want to just turn that off completely, because a lot of times people on the spectrum can see that flickering. I know that I can see that flickering, and it makes me feel nauseated. And just use normal light bulbs. Or if you have access to a good source of natural light, that can be useful too. You don't want to have any distracting, little water fountains in your room, or a clock with a swinging pendulum. Even like flashy jewelry can be distracting. You want to reduce auditory distractions. So sometimes even the hum of appliances. I was teaching a lesson. I mentioned this last time, but it was this great example. I was teaching a lesson in my old studio at a student on the spectrum. I have had a refrigerator in my old studio plugged outside of the room. He was able to hear it through the door, said, that's really distracting me. I went outside, just unplugged the refrigerator, left it off for the duration of that hour, and that was fine. But other things, if people have, some people have white noise generators, even just the sounds from outside, you might want to close your windows just to reduce that type of noise. Olfactory is a big one. A lot of people on the spectrum are really sensitive to smell, so you don't want to use any perfumes. Sometimes you might want to have, the night before, wash the clothing that you're going to wear in that lesson with unscented laundry detergent. Don't use scented dryer sheets. And you probably, if you're teaching in your house, you probably don't want to cook just before a lesson. If you're preparing a meal, maybe schedule the lesson for a time when you won't be cooking. And then in terms of vestibular proprioceptive distraction, really, you don't want to do anything that's going to move too quickly. Sometimes, some folks are fine with this, but I have had students who have had really, really significant vestibular disturbances, so that if their head is moved too quickly, it gives them just tremendous vertigo. And so if you're taking them into Monkey, you want to take them into Monkey really slowly. If they have this issue, not all people on the spectrum have vestibular problems, but some do. And so you might, just ask. And that kind of gets me to, I'll get to this point in just a second. But if you're getting them onto and off of the table, do it fairly slowly. And another thing is, if you're working with a student who has vestibular issues, try to keep your gaze and their gaze on a fairly level, fairly even level, I should say, just so that they don't have to crane their neck up or look down too far to be able to see you. Because that's another thing that can be disruptive. But really what I would recommend is to, in your normal intake interview, which many Alexander Technique teachers do, if you are working with somebody on the spectrum, just ask them what their, what if any, their sensory issues are. many people on the spectrum have very specific sensory issues. Some don't. Some, you know, some may not know exactly what they are, and you kind of find out during the lesson. But as a general rule, if you follow sort of that that overall those overall recommendations, you'll be pretty safe.
Mm-hmm. And I would also imagine, let me know if this is correct, that you might have as a teacher some sort of standard ways of working, and you might find that you would want to modify that.
Yes.
You wouldn't want to be stuck, you know, I got to do this kind of chair work and then this kind of table work and then this kind of monkey or something.
Sure.
You probably would want to be a little more flexible in
being flexible is key. And I mean, really one of the first things you want to do is to kind of reduce your stress response, because some people, I mean, if you're working with a person on the spectrum and you've never met an autistic person before, sometimes autistic people can be just a little bit different to neurotypical people, meaning people who don't have autism. It's just a general term. Mm-hmm. So it can be like meeting somebody from another culture. And so if you're meeting somebody from, you know, oh, I don't know, somebody from France for the first time, and, you know, you've never met somebody from France, and, you know, maybe they have particular things that they like to do. You're meeting somebody from Japan, somebody from, Africa, for the first time. You know, there may be different things that they do. And so it's really just a matter of kind of having patience and sort of stepping back and saying, okay, well, that's the way that this person goes about their business. I will just be accepting of that. So that's really the first thing, is to kind of calm, for the teacher to calm their stress level. Another really important thing, and this is something that that always gets giggles whenever I talk about it in my workshops, is Alexander Technique uses really metaphorical language. And people on the spectrum, autistic people, tend to not really understand metaphors very well. Or they can understand metaphorical language, but just takes an extra layer of processing. So my example for myself is that whenever I hear the term "people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones," I have an image of somebody standing in a glass dome lobbing stones at the ceiling, and then I have a big X that goes
right.
that goes in, you know, that kind of negates that. So I have a visual representation for a metaphor. I have learned what the meaning is of that over time, but when I'm encountering new metaphors, it oftentimes is really confusing for me to understand, what is this person meaning? Okay, they've just thrown a whole bunch of foreign words at me that I'm not quite understanding. I'm going to try and wrap my head around that. You know, I understand metaphor that I understand, but language that is metaphorical that I don't understand can be really confusing. So for Alexander teachers who are working with Alexander language, I highly recommend modifying that language. And the classic example is, of course, Alexander's directions, that let the neck be free to somebody to an autistic person. That may mean a variety of things. That may mean, should my neck be free from my body? Or does that mean, oh, you're going to work on my neck free of charge? Or what does that let the neck be free mean? So an example is just reduce any unneeded tension in your neck. A more literal example of those words might be something like that. Reduce, if you're holding on to tension in your neck, if you're tensing your neck, you can let go of some of that. And then while you're giving them that very literal description of let the neck be free, you're putting hands on and giving that person the experience of what a free neck is. So that is probably one of the biggest modifications, really. Monkey, chair, table, all of these different types of, all of the different Alexander procedures, hands and back of chair. Those, I'll talk about specific modifications for those in a sec, but you can use all of those. Those, you know, those are great. Mm-hmm. But the language really can be a barrier for a lot of folks on the spectrum. So I really recommend that you be hyper literal. I mean, it is kind of flies in the face of typical Alexander Technique work, but it will be very helpful for your students on the spectrum if you're just very specific.
Do you think negative directions could be useful? I am not tensing my neck, or I'm not compressing myself, that sort of thing?
It may be. There may be people who may experience that negative language very literally, though, and may get all kind of tangled up in the I am not, and that may be confusing for them. It's really useful to just be as direct and specific, and it may feel like it may feel like you're kind of dumbing the Alexander directions down a little bit, you know, like what we were all taught to use these specific terms. But the thing is that Alexander's directions, the directions that he developed work for somebody who processes language normally. And what they do for somebody who processes language normally is that person is able to fairly quickly, by comparison to somebody with, somebody on the spectrum, that person is able to fairly quickly form an association between a particular stimulus, such as hands on to allow the neck to be free, a particular stimulus, and that particular word combination, let the neck be free. For somebody who processes language for somebody who processes language literally, that is going to confuse the process a bit. It is not that it's not possible for autistic folks to understand metaphor. I understand metaphor. I know that for myself, when my Alexander teacher first started to talk to me about head forward and up, for instance, even though she was giving me lots and lots of great direction with her hands on what head forward and up was, for the longest time, I kept sticking my head, my neck forward, and tipping my face up, because head forward and up to me meant that I should stick my neck out and tip my face up. And so I was kind of actually fighting against her for a while until she was, and all this actually kind of segues a little bit, until she was able to show me some pictures of what head forward and up was. And then I was able to get it. I was able to understand. So when you're dealing with somebody who, now, I should say that I am perhaps a slightly unusual case in that I am very auditory. I do have an auditory processing problem, so that sometimes if people are speaking softly or if it's late at night, a lot of people have gradations of this. What they're saying sounds like garbledygook to me, but I am much more linguistically oriented than many folks on the spectrum. But even for me, I have come to terms with Alexander's directions at this point. I have embraced them. I understand what they're meaning. But when you're first starting out, I would recommend that you use as literal language as possible. And then over time, you can start to translate that literal language into, well, when you say reduce the tension in your neck, we could also say let the neck be free. That's how Alexander put it. By that point, the person has formed an association between what that initial language is and what the experience in themselves is, and then you can kind of call it what you want to. They will have gotten that in their physical experience. But all of that being said, the other thing that I highly, highly recommend, in addition to using really literal language, is to use visual aids, is to use
a skeleton
presentation.
Right?
A skeleton. Skeletons are great. That gives the person an idea of kind of how they're put together, what's moving, where the joints are. Also, pictures. Use lots and lots of pictures, extra use of pictures, so that, you know, if you have a scrapbook of pictures of people demonstrating, you know, quote unquote good use and quote unquote poor use, use that with your students, with your autistic students. Those will be really, really beneficial. Anything that you can do to demonstrate yourself what you're talking about, and anything that you can do, if the person is comfortable, of course, showing them in the mirror what they're doing. The more blunt you can be, the better, because folks in the autistic people, it's sort of generally more, I guess, PC to say autistic people than people with autism, because if you say people with autism, it kind of means, like, you know, it's like saying a person with a cold, you know, it's something that's a little bit more integral to the way the person functions. But autistic people tend to be, I should say, a little bit obtuse to, if you're trying to, you don't want to talk around things. You just want to state yourself very clearly. So in addition to using literal language and using visual aids, be direct. If, for instance, the autistic person is doing something that maybe makes you feel uncomfortable as a teacher, just tell them. Tell them straight out and say exactly what it is that they're doing that makes you uncomfortable, and then explain to them why it makes you feel uncomfortable, and they will stop.
Oh, okay.
Because of the processing speed delay and the sensory processing issues, it's just hard to get sensory and social data in. And because it's hard to get sensory and social data in, it is just hard to process social interactions. Right. And so people on the spectrum, autistic folks, tend to be a bit gauche. And that's just the nature of the thing.
Right.
You know, and I, you know, I have, the number of times that I've stuck my foot in my mouth, you know, saying something that I shouldn't, and, you know, and I am very grateful to people who say, you know, when you said such and such, that was uncomfortable, or, you know, I didn't like that, or whatever the thing is, because now I know, oh, I understand, I won't do that again. And I've built up a lot of, oh, I won't do that agains over my life.
Right. Oh, that's very interesting.
So you're adding to that person's library of, oh, I won't do that again.
Yeah.
As you're being direct with them, and, you know, and it helps to set boundaries for you. And that's another really important thing, is to set boundaries in your lesson. So in addition to setting those clear boundaries of, you know, well, I didn't like it when, or, well, for instance, let me think, when we were, what would be a good example? When we were doing chair work and you stood up really abruptly and then your face was really, really close to mine, that made me feel uncomfortable. Next time, when you're standing up, if you could just notice where I am and not put your face right next to my face. So that might be an example of, you know, somebody, you know, autistic person maybe being a little bit oblivious to the spatial relationships between one person and another.
Right.
And then you just, you know, very calmly and with a good explanation, explaining what you didn't like and why you didn't like it. And that person is, you know, by gum, they are going to do their damnedest to not do that again. And they will add that to their library of, oh, when I stand up from a chair and somebody is standing right near me, okay, I will not stick my face in their face. And, you know, that, so setting those kind of clear boundaries is important. And also, setting boundaries in terms of the lesson itself, setting a structure to the lesson is also very important. So setting guidelines in terms of time is essential. Mm-hmm. So in addition to all of those boundaries, you want to help the person understand where they are in the lesson and when the lesson is wrapping up and when the lesson is over, because that's another boundary that can be hard for autistic folks to understand. I have a horrible time with knowing kind of where I am in time. A lot of folks on the spectrum do. So one extra boundary is just to say, okay, we have half an hour left your lesson. We're going to do such and such now. Okay, we have 15 minutes left your lesson. We're going to do this and this and this now. Okay, 5 minutes left. Here's what we're going to do. And then, okay, your lesson is over. You know, you can pay me for your lesson now if you do that, or if they pay at the beginning, whichever it is. And then, you know, very, you know, cordially escort them to the door and see them out. So
that's fascinating. I don't think most Alexander teachers would naturally think that.
Right. That's, yeah.
So we're getting a little bit short of time, but I would like to segue just for a couple of minutes to some suggestions for a student who's on the spectrum who wants to explore this work. And are going to be dealing with a teacher who may not have a lot of experience working with people on the spectrum. I guess the first thing I might say as an outsider in all this is get the teacher to listen to this interview. Because I think
that can be very helpful.
I would think that would be helpful. Now, do you have any other specific advice just that we could cover in a couple of minutes for students?
Well, I will get to that in just a second. But one other thing I wanted to say, just one other really important thing, is for teachers, and I can talk about this with the students too, is to make sure to, there are some students with autism, not all, but some autistic folks are very sensitive to a very light touch. Mm-hmm. And so what you want to do is to use maybe a deeper touch than you would normally use when you're working with them. And this is also something that you can ask the student to request as well during their lesson. Just that a light touch can sometimes feel uncomfortable, not always, but can sometimes feel uncomfortable to people with these types of neurological issues. But in terms of a student, really what I would say to somebody on the spectrum, to an autistic person who is thinking about, or somebody with sensory processing disorder, nonverbal learning disability, somebody with these types of neurological challenges who is thinking of taking Alexander Technique lessons, the first thing I would say is be open to the process. It is a process. You may not know where it's going. Mm-hmm. And I would just say to be open to that. When I first started taking lessons, I really had no idea where they were going. I was, it felt kind of like I was being, you know, turned this way and that way, and I wasn't quite sure what was happening. But I knew that it really felt very beneficial to me. It was a really good feeling. Mm-hmm. So be open to the process. At the same time, do not, you know, never be afraid to state your needs. If your teacher is doing something that is uncomfortable or makes you feel uncomfortable, maybe they're using a hand contact that makes your skin feel a little bit zingy or something like that, tell them that. Mm-hmm. If you are not comfortable with eye contact, for instance, and your teacher wants to make eye contact with you right away in maybe, you know, in the first few lessons, and you're not ready to do that, just tell them that. Be very open, very very honest, and as specific as you can be really will help your teacher know what you need for them to be able to help you. The one thing I will say is that autistic folks and also people with sensory processing disorder and various other sensory processing issues oftentimes have a really heightened stress response. And it can feel really scary to experience something new. And this is something that's really good for both people with neurological differences and for Alexander teachers to know and to acknowledge that, you know, that this can be a scary process, but just to, you know, to just keep calm and carry on, and that the process of Alexander technique really will be beneficial.
Hey, well, that's excellent. And your own experience, and I assume experience of numerous students you've had, who are on the spectrum, suggested that the technique can be especially beneficial in some ways for people.
It really can be. It is, you know, it is the only kind of real close similarity is occupational therapy, which many autistic folks and people with sensory processing disorder receive when they're young, but it is, Alexander technique is so much more refined in terms of the hands-on work, and also in terms of the understanding of inhibition and direction. I mean, you really go back to those two hallmarks of the Alexander technique, that, you know, that ability to take the time that you need to say no to stimulus, to know when you're feeling overwhelmed, and to know that you have the choice to leave that overwhelming situation. If you're in a room with flickering lights or buzzing sounds, that you can excuse yourself. Mm-hmm. That even if you need to be in that room, that you have the tools that you can use to calm down your nervous system. And then in terms of the direction, to feel where you are in space, to know where you are in space, to have the experience of moving through space in a coordinated way, those are essential and are two things that autistic folks, folks with sensory processing issues, generally speaking, have a lot of trouble with. And those are areas that Alexander technique just is really immensely beneficial.
Well, I think that'd be a great place to end our conversation. So my guest today has been Caitlin Freeman. She's an Alexander Technique teacher in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She has a lot of experience working with people with autism. She's presented at the Autism Society. She's also the author of Autism and Alexander Technique, a book. It has a subtitle, but if you search for that on Amazon or anywhere, you will find it. We're going to put a link to her website by the interview, and I believe on your site you have a bit of written material on the topic of Alexander technique and autism.
Yes, yeah, I do.
So there'll be something there. I'll also put a link to a site that will enable you to learn more about the Alexander technique more generally, and to locate a teacher in your area. So, Caitlin, thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. Just